Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Yama, I'm Bo Spearham, a Kumaroi, Kuma and Marawari, and welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the country on which we are broadcasting from and also to. Also, I'd like to pay my respects to our elders, also our elders of more recent arrival, and everybody around the continent that is tuning in via the National Indigenous Radio Service NERS or via our website, 989fm.com.au. So today is the 11th anniversary of Mark Mason Sr., a Gumaroi man, First Nations man, who was shot by police officers in November 2011. Today, the family, the friends and the loved ones are currently in Sydney and they are having a rally for Mark with his children. And I dare say his close friends and family. He was a First Nations man from northern New South Wales. This anniversary comes in the same week as two Aboriginal men, one who died in prison custody at Shortlands Correctional Centre in Cessnock. That man was 26 years old and he was reported unresponsive in his cell at 6:50 a.m. and was pronounced dead at 7 a.m. Also, officers had shot and killed another First Nations man who was 45 years old in Surry Hills in the western suburbs of Sydney. As I mentioned, this comes... we got the news of this on the same day that these two men passed away due to their proximity to police and prison. This continues to happen in this country, and it's something that, as First Nations media, we will continue to report on and follow up with family members. So I'll be definitely following this up with, if not their families, journalists and then also legal professionals as well. Also, today is a very significant today because it is the 11th of the 11th, which marks Remembrance Day, which marks the end of the fighting on the Western Front on November 11th. 1918. I've got Denny joining me in the studio as well to have a yarn about this as well and to, you know, bring some light because you, I guess on a personal note, you were in the army, is that right?
Yeah, I joined the Australian Army in 1994 and I served in the full-time service for 5 or 6 years. It's an interesting day. Well, I remember that it makes me think about the Aboriginal history in the military and times of service since the Boer War and, you know, up to Vietnam and Afghanistan more recently. But, it always makes me think about the Frontier Wars as well, Remembrance Day, and lest we forget the Frontier Wars, you know. I think it's a really important date for blackfellas to remember our own sort of history in terms of war.
And I guess and in no way it's sort of diminishing, you know, the lives that were lost. It's saying, hey, wait a minute, there needs to be a remembrance or, you know, something like that in the consideration for the Aboriginal lives that participated in these. As you mentioned, nearly in every single war that's been fought, Aboriginal people participated in. And then also in every conflict that happened on this continent, Aboriginal people were drawn into as well.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, one of the interesting things that I found out, you know, years ago was the Boer War. Aboriginal trackers went to be a part of the Boer War in South Africa. And sadly, they were left.
Yeah, they're left behind over there, Mark Grange. A lot of young Aboriginal men joined as well on the notion, you know, because it's so horrible here for them, what was going on in terms of colonisation, the frontier wars happening here and the genocide sort of happening across the country. And so a lot of young brothers, I researched this a few years ago when I was a journalist, but a lot of them were sort of 14, 15 or 16 and they told people that they were Indians, that they were migrants or, you know, not Aboriginal. They were 14 or 15. They said they were 17 or 18 so they could join and conscript into the service. And they did that to get away from the wars that were happening here, which is quite ironic. They joined to go and fight another war overseas to get away from the wars that were fighting here because it was spears against gun. It was really a horrible, horrible time reading back about it. But so a lot of them went over there and fought in the war and joined and were trackers and those sort of things. But as it stands, as history sort of tells us, you know, they were all left behind over there in unmarked graves and a lot of them just left to fend for themselves alive. So, you know, we've probably got a lot of Aboriginal mob walking around over there in Africa.
For sure. And it comes at a time, as you mentioned, you know, so it was coming the late, you know, 1800s. So when frontier wars was, you could say, at its peak, you know, and I just got some numbers, you know, that I want to sort of read out as well. So in 1981, Henry Reynolds, in his book, The Other Side of the Frontier, he estimated the figures of Aboriginal people who died on the frontier at the time, with his research, was 20,000. And then in 2014, two researchers from the University of Queensland, Robert Jensen and Raymond Evans, their estimate of the number of Aboriginal people killed in Queensland alone was around 60,000.
Wow.
But then also from recent research from Dr. Lindley Wallace, who is was an archaeologist, and
I know Lindley.
Yeah. She's doing some really amazing work in that space and uncovering some things. So what she estimated was that in a 50-year period from the 1850s to the early 1900s, is that about 100,000 Aboriginal people died in the frontier in Queensland alone.
Wow.
That's not counting the other states. Yeah. As well, you know, and we know sort of how violent Tasmania was. There's lots of research and books and about that. We know a bit of history about Victoria as well, another brutal frontier as well, as well as most places here in Australia are. But as I mentioned before, it's not to sort of diminish the lives that were lost in any war. It's to sort of start a conversation and add this to that conversation. This is a part of, you know, our history of war in this country. And as you mentioned, some of these young men didn't want to participate in the war, the frontier conflict here.
Well, they had no choice, really.
They had no choice.
You know, they were refugees in their own country, so they they joined the military to flee, you know. It was either that or be one of those statistics that you're just talking about, the 60,000 lost. So, yeah, and then you look at World War II, you look at World War I, World War II. Vietnam is an amazing story. So many Aboriginal mob went to Vietnam. Either got conscripted. There was national conscription back then. And they were treated horribly on return, and that's a pattern that we see from World War I, World War II and Vietnam. Aboriginal diggers were treated absolutely abhorrently upon return and in almost, you know, segregated and apartheid-type conditions. They were, you know, fighting wars for other people and protecting Australians, and then when they came back, they weren't allowed in pubs.
Weren't allowed in certain restaurants, had to go at the back.
Yeah, you know. Still had the whites-only sort of areas whatnot, so...
And that couldn't swim in the pool in Moree.
Where
we're from, literally, you know?
Yeah, it's all those sort of things. So you could wear the Australian military uniform, you could protect the country and you know, taking a number of lives from an enemy force, but when you're brought back to this country, you're still treated as the enemy. So, yeah, it's quite horrific, all those stories. And I guess for me, when I joined the Army, I didn't have a real great understanding of Aboriginal history in the Army and how they were treated. I think had I known and done my research, I was only 17 back then, but had I probably known, I might not have joined.
Mm.
Might have, you know. But at that time in my life, it was a one-way ticket out of Moree for me. I didn't do very well at academia. My footy career was over. Too small for that. And so joining the army was, it was a bit like them old fellas back in the day. It was a way to get out of, you know, I wanted to see the world, not just, you know, what was in Moree.
And thanks for coming on and having a Shan with us as well, Danny, because as we mentioned, you know, we want to sort of continue to shine light on Aboriginal lives, whether that's on the frontier or who enlisted in all the wars that were fought either under the Australian flag or the British flag, as well, because I think the Boer War, World War One, maybe two, I don't know if they were officially flying the flag on the soldiers' arm, I think.
Yeah, I think we're still under the
British.
Yeah, the British Empire. The British Imperial Forces, I think they were called. My history doesn't
yeah. remember. But now, thanks for coming on, brother, and sharing that, and also sharing your personal story of joining as well. This is definitely something that everybody living in this country should definitely explore as well. Coming up right now is I'm going to play an interview that I recorded with Kerry Palmer, who is a class action senior associate with Maurice Blackburn in the Sydney office. So recently in the Northern Territory, on Monday, was the NT Youth Class Action. And that class action was started in the Federal Court of Australia in December 2016 by two young people, one Indigenous and one non-Indigenous, who were represented by Maurice Blackburn, who were claiming compensation money from the NT government for young people who were in youth detention because officers illegally used too much force, handcuffing, strip searching and isolation. The compensation money and cost can only be made if the judge approves them and says they are fair. The cost will also be checked by an independent cost expert to make sure that the money is evenly spread across. And the NT government has agreed to pay $35 million in compensation to run this class action. And I start this interview off by asking Kerry a bit about herself, what she does, and also this class action.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very pleased to be talking to you today about this case.
Just really quickly, tell us a bit about yourself, the work you do, and where you're from.
Yes, my name's Kerry Palmer. I'm based in Sydney. I'm a senior associate with Maurice Blackburn Lawyers, working in the class actions practice, where we run cases mainly in the federal court, but also in the state courts under the class action regime. So bringing cases where lots of people have suffered the same injustice and we can get justice for them in the one case rather than them all having to have their cases run separately.
And just for our listeners as well, and I'd like to think my listenership is well aware of the issues regarding Dundale and the use of force that was used by guards on young people in 2016. I believe there was a Four Corners report on Dundale, which highlighted the heavy-handed treatment. It's interesting, actually, because I grabbed that blurb that I read before off the Maurice Blackburn website. So it's interesting to see that the NT government does not admit that the officers acted illegally. Before we go any further as well, you know, in regards to the treatment of the young people, when you sort of hear a state or a territory government say those things, it must be sort of a bit of alarming, you know, to say the least.
To say that they don't admit the liability?
Yeah.
It, particularly in the context where there's been an entire royal commission over this. And the findings of the Royal Commission were very clear that there had been terrible mistreatment of young people in youth detention, and laid out a lot of those findings on that. So those have also been acknowledged by the Northern Territory government. The minister, in fact, who was the Minister for Territory Families at the time, the Northern Territory, the Royal Commission report was handed down. There was a statement made in Parliament about the findings of those things. And so having acknowledged that in Parliament and had those findings, it is surprising that the Northern Territory continued to fight this case so hard. We've continued on from 2017 right through till May this year.
And in regards to this class action, as I mentioned, it sort of began in December 2016 with two individuals. How did, this come across Maurice Blackburn or yourself to represent this case?
Yes, it might be a bit surprising that Sydney lawyers are involved in this class action, but how we did get involved was we have an office in Darwin. Maurice Blackburn has an office in Darwin. And after the Four Corners report, which exposed a lot of this terrible mistreatment of young people in youth detention, Northern Territory Legal Aid and NAJA, the Aboriginal Legal Service in the Northern Territory, began referring claims for in relating to this mistreatment to Maurice Blackburn's Darwin office. And we looked at those and saw that the mistreatment was so widespread and that there were so many young people affected by it that we thought it was best to run it as a class action. And Maurice Blackburn has got a long history of running class actions like this, big, complicated class actions. So we thought it was best to run as a class action, and so that's why we commenced it like this, so that we can bring all of those claims together in one case.
If I could just jump in, you mentioned that you have this history of jumping in and sort of taking on cases, you know, that are big and are like this as well. What's the, is there issue or sort of trouble or, I don't know, concern around such a big case like this or other class actions that you've done in the past where it may seem the sort of difficult part to sort of, get somewhat justice for the clients and in particular these young people who were in Dondale between 2006 and 17?
Yeah, because the cases are so big is why they're so hard fought. The big issue is they're so hard fought. So this case has run for 5 years. It's been very hard fought every step of the way, and that's what we find in class actions, that because because we're bringing all the claims in one case, that adds up to a lot of compensation and very big claims, and so that they are very hard fought, and whatever legal and procedural things that the defendants can throw at them, they will do that. One of the things that we do have to show for it to be a class action is that the same sort of thing, either the same sort of legal claims or the same sort of factual issues, the same sort of mistreatment has happened to people. And so a lot of the complications in class actions can come out of that.
So that's in relation to sort of everything coming out, and also in regards to the Royal Commission that happened. Was that 2016 or 17?
So we started the case in 2016. The reason that the claim period or the mistreatment that happened, we can give compensation for the mistreatment that happened up to 2017, is that in 2017 we filed new court documents making changes to the case. And so because we filed new documents at that time, the cut-off date for the claims became that new date when we filed those new claims. So at the moment, everyone who was in youth detention from August 2006 right through to November 2017 can claim compensation. And the reason for the 2006 is because the law that we brought the class action under, the Youth Justice Act in the Northern Territory, started in August 2006.
So just recently you had the hearing as well. I don't know if you could talk about specifics in regards to that, but I guess broadly, how did the judge react, I guess, and you know, could you let us know of some of the outcomes if that is possible? If not, but yeah.
Sure. So the hearing was on Monday, the 8th of November, and the reason for that hearing was for the judge to approve the settlement. We were putting forward the settlement for the judge's approval. The court in a class action supervises any settlement to make sure that it's fair for everyone in the case. And so we have to get court approval for the overall settlement, but also for how each person's compensation money is going to be worked out. So the reason for the hearing on Monday was for the judge to look at the settlement and decide whether it was fair for everyone. And then the other thing we were asking for in that hearing was an extension of time for people to register their claim, because we have about 1,200 people that we know were in youth detention during that period. And at the moment, registrations are 488 at this minute, so as I speak. There are a lot more people who haven't heard about it or don't know enough about it to know to register. And we were asking for more time up until the 30th of June next year, 2022, for people to have the opportunity to register. Yeah, so what happened in the hearing was that the judge asked us a lot of questions and had read all the materials. We filed about 450 pages of evidence in support of what we're proposing, the settlement and how it's going to work, how people's compensation is going to be worked out, and also why we're asking for the extension. And the judge listened very carefully to all of that and listened very carefully to all that the people who'd been in youth detention said about what it was like being there. And the judge, Justice Mortimer, is now taking some time to think about all of that and will make a judgment soon. We don't have an indication of the timing of that, but we know that that's going to be as soon as Justice Mortimer can make a judgment on it.
That's great. Hopefully, you know, he does fall to sort of, you know, what is being asked and extends that, opens it up, and, you know, hopefully more young kids can be a part of that. In relation to the class action for young people who were in youth detention as well, we were sort of chatting off air as well, and you were mentioning that, you know, this sort of opens up the sort of space for other states and territories to sort of do the same thing as well. Could you sort of talk to that and the importance, I guess, of other states and territories getting involved in such class action, and if there has been, you know, similar, you know, class actions like this?
Yes. So when these mistreatment of young people in youth detention came to light in the Northern Territory, and there was discussion at the national level about a Royal Commission, a lot of the state's legal services, the legal aid and Aboriginal legal services in other states said the same thing's happening here. We need our state to be part of this Royal Commission. And coming out of that, a lot of focus has come on the way children in youth detention are treated. And so we know that in New South Wales, where I'm based, there's been similar mistreatment in youth detention, and Maurice Blackburn has run a test case about that relating to how long young people were kept in isolation, in solitary confinement, in cells. That was run as a test case because of some specifics to do with the law in New South Wales. And we are aware that other cases have been brought in Western Australia, and other cases are being considered in other states around the country. But I think what this is showing is that the similar issues are happening all over the country, and really the entire country needs all of those systems, needs really careful reform of youth detention, because it's not working in any of those states or territories.
And I don't know if you could sort of say so, but in regards to the two young men who you were working with in the Northern Territory, are they Aboriginal? And have most of those people who've come forward identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander?
95% of the people who were in youth detention during that time are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. We know that at some times 100% of the young people who were in youth detention at the time were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And so the vast majority of people who've registered are also, you know, that's the way that the split is. The lead applicants, Dylan Jenkins is Aboriginal and Aaron Hyde is not. He's non-Aboriginal.
It's when some of the young kids, or young men, I should say, were locked up and, you know, they're coming forward, to think that, 90 to sort of even more percent were First Nations and have experienced that, is pretty scary. Obviously, knowing the stats, at one point in time, I believe, I think it was 100%, Indigenous population in Don Dale, and it's scary to think that.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to say as well, in terms of who was in youth detention during that time, about 70% of the young people who were in youth detention and a part of this class action were there on remand. They were there, they weren't given bail, and often that was because they were not sentenced to be there. They were there on remand because they didn't get bail, and often that was because they didn't have a safe home to go to. And so there's a lot of opportunity for the system to be reformed, for justice reinvestment. Instead of putting the very high amount of money that they're having to put into youth detention to keep people in youth detention like that, putting them into putting that money into social services and support for families before children get to that point, is going to be way more effective for the children themselves, but also for the community. And one of the things that the young men who spoke in the hearing on Monday about what happened to them in youth detention and their experiences there, they talked at length about how they really wanted to have some guidance from the officers there about how to live in a way outside youth detention that would help them get onto a good path in life. They wanted some training and education and life skills, and that was all they were after, and some loving care. And that would have completely changed things for them and helped them get off that track. But because they didn't receive that, they followed a path that they were hoping to get off and trying to get off. And they talked about how their hopes now and the way they want to use the compensation money is to help young people, the next generation, help them not follow the path that they have, not end up on that track and where they are now, so that they can divert them out of the system and help them get onto a good path in life.
I just hope, that's the case, and these young men, I'll follow that and do support the next generation as well. Just for my listeners, really quickly, I've been yarning with Kerry Palmer from Maurice Blackburn. We've been talking about the Northern Territory Youth Class Action. There was a hearing on Monday, and I guess, as you mentioned, you will be resuming some more court hearing at a further date once the judge makes his or her decision.
The judge may want another hearing if she has more questions, but it's possible that we've provided enough information for Justice Mortimer to be able to decide about it. without needing another hearing. We'll be sending out a notice to people who are part of this case after that. And if anyone, I would say if anyone knows anyone who could be part of the case, that please call Maurice Blackburn. Please have them call Maurice Blackburn and we'll be able to help them with registration. So at the moment, registrations are open until we get the orders from the court. But we're asking people to please contact us as soon as possible if they might be part of the class action so that we can help them work that out and to register for their compensation.
Definitely.
Everyone who was in youth detention during that time is entitled to compensation under the scheme that we've put to the court for approval. Yeah, I just want to let everyone know that everyone who was in youth detention from August 2006 to November 2017 can claim compensation. Thank you. It's just been a real honour to run this case. Sorry.